friends. My name is Lauka, and I am the author of the historical novel Returning East. This novel is set on an ocean liner in Hong Kong and in China in 1954. I am very fascinated by Asia in general, South Asia, Southeast Asia, East Asia, and in particular China, where I lived for about 6 years. But I know I am not the only one. And this is why I teamed with other authors who also wrote at least one novel set in Asia or with an Asian protagonist. And because I was curious to hear more about their connections with this region, I decided to ask them and to record a few podcasts. Now, I am not a professional podcast host, so I hope you will forgive any mistakes I may have done. But the conversations I had with those authors are very interesting, and I hope you will enjoy listening to their experiences and to hear more about their books and about my book as well. In this third podcast, I am joined by Liz Harris, author of several historical novels, four of which are set in Asia, and Walt Mussel, whose novels are, so far at least, all set in Japan. So I hope you will enjoy our conversation. Good evening. I am here with two authors that joined the promotion Awesome Asia. And I have here Liz Harris and Walt Mussel. Welcome to join me. I'm very excited to have you here and to have a chat about our books, our connection with Asia, and so on. But maybe first a short introduction. Where are you from? And maybe what genre you're writing? And very brief, resume, let's say. Do you want to start, Liz?
Thank you, Laura. Yes, I'm Liz Harris. And I'm a writer of historical fiction, which tends to have a love story in it. And also I have done some contemporary fiction set in Umbria. I've written 16 novels and four of them are set in Asia. And I'm going to enjoy telling you about them this evening.
Okay, perfect. Thank you very much. And Walter, what about you?
I'm Walt Mussel. I live in the Atlanta area. Basically, I only have four books. I have three that I've written. I'm working on my fourth one. They're all set in Asia. I write historical fiction and historical fantasy with Christian and romantic elements. And what I mean by that is there's Christianity in the story because of the time period, and there's romance in the story, but they are elements of the plot and not the overriding arc of the plot.
Okay.
So it's pure historical fiction.
Okay. That's interesting. I mean, you definitely have more books than I have because I just have one. So don't complain, Walter.
Gotta start somewhere.
Exactly.
My book I'm working on has been taking me a while.
Yes. And how did you start writing? Maybe you can first answer this question, Walt. Do you prefer me calling Walt or Walter?
Walt, please.
Okay.
I always prefer that because my dad went by Walter, so I thought it made it easier.
Okay.
Also, when I lived in Japan, it was just easier to say Walt, like Walt Disney.
Yeah.
And everybody got it immediately.
That's correct.
I started writing a little bit in Japan. I did a few stories for shortwave radio, Japan shortwave radio, when I was living in Tokyo. And after that, I sort of put it away, started doing a newsletter for my alumni group when I lived in Portland, Oregon. And eventually I got moved to write, I'd say about between 12 to 15 years ago, to finally try putting together a novel. My first work was actually not fiction. I was trying to do a humorous look at marriage. That book is still sitting somewhere deep in my computer, never to be found.
Okay, thanks. And yep. Lisa, what about you? Or do you want to add anything?
Don't want to add anything?
Yeah,
Well,
how you started writing.
I tried doing stuff, and because I was with a group, because my writers group I joined did mostly fiction. They said, "Walt, stop doing nonfiction. Try writing a novel." And I worked at a lot of things. Nothing seemed to work. And then on a family visit to Japan, my wife is Japanese. So on a family visit to Japan, we were looking at Himeji Castle. And Himeji Castle is the castle that everyone, if they've seen a castle in Japan, they've seen Himeji. It was used in Shogun. It was used in You Only Live Twice. It was in The Last Samurai. The one everybody knows, six stories, White Heron. Japanese castles have protective medallions to protect against fires, floods, tsunami, you name it. Himeji has a cross as one of its, basically one of its under the eaves of its roof. And which was particularly interesting about this is Japan went through a period where they were trying to stamp out every last image of Christianity within the country. Somehow this image survived. It was totally in your face. And because of that image, that's when I started writing historical fiction.
Okay, that's an interesting story.
That's a little long, sorry, but that's kind of what got me
Yeah.
started down the path. And my first book is actually set at a major castle.
Okay. That's nice. But the book in the promotion is not your first book that you
No, my first book, I just got the rights back to it. I won a writing contest with it. And so Amazon had it for a few years, and they finally got the rights back, but they made me hold it off for a little while to clear the sales pages,
Okay.
everything. And so it finally re-releases tomorrow, and that's The Samurai's Heart. The book and the promotion is A Second Chance, and it's mostly still historical fiction, but time travel.
Okay.
A Japanese business, we can talk about that later, or
Yeah.
go
Definitely,
ahead.
we can talk later.
Gotcha.
Okay, Lisa, how did you start writing? Well, with 14 books, you probably started at least a couple of years ago.
Well, I did, but when I was very, very young at school, primary school, very young, I read absolutely everything. I've adored reading all my life. I read all of Dickens by the time I was about 13 or 14. I read the Russian writers. And I also enjoyed writing. I loved doing exams. I loved doing my degree exams. I loved doing some of the answers. They were so funny. I've just always enjoyed it. If they asked me to imagine I was a donkey in the Sahara, I would do it. I'd enjoy it. It just had never occurred to me to connect my love of reading and my love of writing to make a book. It was only when my sons were very young and I had a bit of time on my hands, and of course, all writers love words, and I think you've already observed I could come up with a few words. I started writing lots of letters to my friends because I wanted to write great voluminous epistles that went on for page after page after page in handwriting. And one day, one of my friends came to me, look at weary, exhausted, and said, "For goodness sake, write a book." Oh, I thought, that's an idea. And I did. And that's when I started writing. I did write for 7.5 years, holding my craft before the road back when I was accepted for publication. And that was my first book set in the Indian province of Ladakh and also in London.
Okay, that's also very interesting. Walter, may I ask you if you're typing not to type or to mute yourself if you're typing? Because I hear some typing on the background, if I'm not wrong.
Doing anything. I just need to hold the chair I'm sitting in, probably.
Oh, okay, sorry. Because I was
I'll try
hearing.
muting myself. I'll mute myself when Liz talks.
Okay.
You're probably tempted to mute me at the same time.
No. You said that your first book is also set in Asia, right? Would you like to discuss about to talk us through your connection with Asia?
Yes, it's through my late uncle. He was in the 1940s, he was a major in the army and he was stationed in North India. He was a very clever man, very interested in history. And in fact, he became an antiques dealer, very good antiques, and a curator at local museums in later years. But he'd heard a lot about Ladakh, an Indian province west of Tibet. really wanted to go there, and he managed by a lot of persuasion, he also had learned a couple of Indian dialects, to get one of three very, very rare passes. And he journeyed into Ladakh, and he kept a complete record of everywhere he went, everyone he met, everything he saw. And there were pictures that he's drawn, photos that he's taken, and his writing. The whole lot was compiled in an album, about which I knew nothing until 2010. Although I met my uncle, I lived near him and I saw him so many times. However, he's since died. But his daughter, my cousin, phoned me from Australia in 2010 and said the green ink with which he wrote was fading and no one in Australia was interested in preserving it, but she thought it was a very historic document. And could I find a home? I did, and it's now in the Indian Room in the British Library on Euston Road in London. Mm-hmm. And it is absolutely fascinating. I had it for 2 weeks before I had to hand it over. I fell completely in love with everything I read, and then I promptly went out and I started buying books. And I found a terrific book about the culture, because the thing that is so fascinating is learning about the culture of people. And if you can do, as I tried to do, put that with a good story, then I think you have what I would describe as a perfect read.
Yeah.
So that was the first of my books in Asia.
Okay. Which year was he there, did you say? Your uncle?
My uncle was in the 1940s, so he was early on. At that time, borders were closed. Yeah. China had closed the border to Tibet, and nobody could fly into the airport in Leh, which was the capital, apart from foreign officials and diplomats. So my uncle, they trekked all through places like Srinagar. That would be so dangerous today. We'd call it kidnap country. But I've got a record of it in my book, because my uncle had a record of it in his book. And he even kept lists of what he ordered from the bearers and how much he had to pay. I thought it was fascinating. And I thought what I learned about the religious beliefs in Ladakh was so moving, in fact. I mean, before they even start planting the Ladakhi, they apologize to the worms and to the little insects in the ground who are going to be destroyed, or at least disturbed, if not destroyed, by their efforts. But of course, they have to plant to grow food. So the whole of their Buddhism, Leh is in the Buddhist part of Ladakh. The other half, the Western part now, is Islamic. But the whole of Buddhism, it inhabits their lives. It invades their lives in a way that even deeply religious people in England, it's unusual to see people whose belief is so much a part of them that it's endemic to them. I thought it was fascinating. And I had waiting in my head a character called Patricia, who was born in London in the 1950s in a part of the world where I was born and know very well. And I had Patricia's story waiting to emerge, and I decided the two could go together. So I found a story very, very interesting. Ladakh has no rain, virtually no rain at all. It's such a high mountain plateau that they rely on melt snow water. And because of that, they have a social organization in their families. They all live together in large families. Social organization that affects the fourth son. And Mike Haldon, my Ladakhi man, was, of course, a fourth son. But I never tell anybody what that was, because I want them to buy the book. Would rather repeat the purpose. But it was just fascinating, a wonderful place. And I would have gone, definitely would have gone, but my doctor, I have very low blood pressure, said that I would be very ill. It was too high an altitude. So I had to wait to go to Asia when I wrote Darjeeling Inheritance, and I went to Asia for that. Okay. And then Vietnam.
Yeah, it reminds me, you know, the story of Alexandra David Neal. I don't know if any of you knows this French writer. She was a sinologist, and then she wrote also about her experiences. She traveled to, in particular, to Tibet, but it was early, you know, it was 1920, 1930, something like that. And her books are also very fascinating and very much pregnated also with Buddhist culture. Yeah. Never heard about
it. No. I got the book that I found absolutely wonderful. It was called Ancient Futures, Learning from Ladakh. It was by Helena Norberg Hodge. I thought it was an absolutely wonderful book, and of course it's credited in the acknowledgements. I learned so much from it. But I got trekking in Ladakh, and it's amazing what you can do on YouTube. I couldn't go in person, but if I closed my eyes, I could tell you every single stone in the village wall around Kaldan's village, because I have trekked with so many hikers over Ladakh. The airport is open now. The borders are open. It's considered one of the most beautiful places to go to, and one of the most wonderful hiking meccas in the world. So I know so much about Ladakh, despite not having been there, which was sad. I would love to go, but I know I can't.
Yeah, well, who knows, maybe in the future. And
pump up blood pressure a little bit more, then yes.
What about you? What is your connection with Asia? Would you like to tell us a little bit more about it?
Sure. I went there in the early 90s to basically taught English under what's called the JET program. It's a program that the government hires English-speaking nationals from a number of different countries, puts them in the school system. And originally, I grew up in the 80s. So that was when the Japan was in the ascendancy and Theory Z and things like that. And Japan was going to be number one. So I thought, here's a way I got interested. Here's a way to go learn about the country. And once I got there, I actually fell in love with the place, particularly the history. Spent 4 years there, met my wife there. She is Japanese, but she is a, she speaks English like she speaks English like a native. Her dad was an overseas exec.
Mm-hmm.
So that when she came back to Japan, we met, really kind of an interesting way. People say, oh, we know at first sight and everything. My wife went out with me because I had a really bad pickup line. So, and what I mean by that is I've been in the country 3 years, and yet the pickup line was so bad, she realized that wasn't how I spent my weekends. So I was probably a nice guy. But we got engaged in there. We got married in the U.S. and we've been together 27 years. She's now an American citizen.
Mm-hmm. Your connection with Japan, then it goes on, because probably she has family there and you regularly go back to Japan.
Unfortunately, we haven't been back since 2008. We do have family there. Her parents live in California, so we get to see them more often.
I see.
But we haven't seen a family in a long time. And when I saw him at AG Council, which I mentioned earlier, that was on our last trip. So that was the last. My two sons, the older son has been to Japan 3 times. The younger son has been twice. And the younger son complains that his older brother got to go one more time. And we're like, well, you weren't alive the first time. Not much we can do about that. We registered the births in Japan, everything. Yeah. They have Japanese names in addition to their American ones.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the connection, and it is a love affair.
Yes. So you can also speak Japanese fluently now, or are you still like that?
I used to speak Japanese, but during when my wife and I were dating, we got into a huge fight because I misunderstood something she said. And if I wanted to keep her, I better just accept the fact that her English is better than my Japanese and go with that.
I see. Okay. For love's sake, you put your Japanese skills aside.
I put my Japanese skills aside. I mean, I can still speak it a little. I can talk. And it's gotten bad. I've been gone for 28 years. I've only visited 3 times since. So they've deteriorated is the best word, I guess.
Yes, yeah, I totally understand. I mean, I studied Chinese and I lived in China, but my Chinese is really downgraded since I've been living in Berlin. So I understand. And
Lizzie, I said too, I've been studying Chinese a bit myself recently because of where I work. And the odd thing that people figured out is I can read it better than I can speak it.
Okay.
It's really funny because a lot of the characters are so similar.
It's true, absolutely. Yes.
Yes.
It's something much easier if you know some Japanese and vice versa. And Lisa, if I'm not wrong, you also worked in a Japanese company, so you also have a connection with Japan?
Yes, I worked when I lived in California. I lived there for 6 years and I worked for a Japanese trading company, a very large one. And I was fortunate because my employer's wife was in Japan. So I got to go on all the social occasions, sort of being hostess, organizing things, seeing that everything went well. And I got to know a lot of the Japanese people, liked them enormously. And in fact, we were very lucky. My boss and I were invited, something he said is very, very rare, to the home of the man who was in charge of the steel division. And my boss explained, it's extremely unusual that people are invited in Japan to each other's homes. Mm-hmm. And he stood, I knew the steel man, I remembered him clearly. His wife, we considered, the Americans and English considered she was the most beautiful of all the wives. My boss told me that in Japanese standards, she was not considered particularly beautiful, but we thought she was stunning. And I remember the steel man crying on the day his third daughter was born, that it wasn't a son. So when we went to their home, I thought it'd be like going to any ordinary home in America, because they lived all among the American houses in a residential area. And I was familiar with Chinatown in Los Angeles, though it was small, and also in San Francisco. So I remember asking my boss, why you don't all live together? There's a very nice street with all the Japanese shops and Japanese foods and restaurants. Why don't you all live there? And he said, we don't have a ghetto mentality. We prefer to live among the people with whom we work. So we went to this home and I thought it would be like all the other American homes, but it was totally different. The wife did not sit down at all to eat with us. The first person to be fed was my boss, and I sort of sat there thinking, what's going on? The second person to be fed was her husband, when my boss had approved it. When they were both eating and comfortable, I was then given food, and she would not be eating till we had finished. It was a totally different style, but it was lovely to see how other people live. I don't say that that is the way I would have liked to live, always being last to have my food. I'm nearly always first at the table when I stay in places, but I did find it fascinating. I felt very privileged that they obviously liked my boss and they were used to seeing me around, that they did something that wasn't particularly usual for them and made me feel particularly welcome in a way that they probably couldn't have anticipated. And I think possibly little incidents like that, because I really did enjoy working for the Japanese and liked them enormously and learned a little bit of the language, perhaps began a real interest in Asia in the wider sense and the other countries of Asia as well.
Yeah.
Can I mention something?
Yes, of course.
There is a Japanese custom about not. His wife may have been stunning. It's just that the custom would have prohibited him from saying anything.
Oh, right.
So basically, he couldn't say, he couldn't extol his wife, maybe. He may think his wife is drop dead gorgeous, but it would be impolite of him to basically extol his wife that way.
Well, it was my boss.
For some people, particularly older people.
It was my boss who was saying that the Japanese didn't really consider her particularly beautiful. And we thought she was absolutely lovely. It was a different style of beauty, which you see when you see pictures, when you go around the world and you see the pictures in the galleries, you can see a country's what they believe is beautiful, and it isn't necessarily what we believe is beautiful, which is one of the things when you write historical fiction or any sort of fiction, it's always the things that are most different from what we're used to, that are the things that we should put an emphasis on, because that will transport the reader into the world, which is what we want. We're not just telling them it or showing them it, because they could either get a travel guide or they could read a non-fiction book. We are actually transporting them, and all the differences in their culture and ours, these are the things that bring the places alive.
Indeed. And Liz, you mentioned a little bit already about watching YouTube videos with the trackers so that you could do some research. So I don't know if you want to expand on that, how you do your research on those books so that, you know, from countries that are so far away. Yes. You haven't lived in Asia, have you?
I haven't lived in Asia, but I have traveled. When I decided, after I did the three books in America and I went to Wyoming, So that is, although Wyoming is surprisingly high in altitude, it is nowhere near as high as Ladakh is. And so I had a deadline for my book and I couldn't find answers to the questions that I needed. I needed to know answers about the way a second generation homesteader would have lived. So when my husband said to me one May, where are we going on holiday this year? And I had a deadline of September. The fact that my husband loathes the heat and the sun did go into my mind, but left very quickly. And I said to him, Wyoming. And we went there in August. We had a wonderful time, but exploring it was absolutely superb. And I went to every single museum. So when I decided, after three books set in America, that I was going to set something in Asia again, I had always the road back in the back of my mind. I had so enjoyed writing that. We booked to go to Darjeeling, to fly to Calcutta, spend a few days there, go up to Kalimpong to see the views from there, spend a day in the village, cross through tea gardens and stay in all the lovely places in Darjeeling. I was going to stay in the Glenbourne Tea Estate, the Windermere Hotel. And then exactly 2 months to the day before we were going in October, trail finders with whom we were traveling were told by the Foreign Office there was a big caution. There was trouble in the area between the Bengali and the Nepalese, and the tea gardens have been closed for months. Well, teas bushes are not bushes, they're actually trees. So, and the Windermere Hotel, they were all closed. So the tea estates were closed. So we had to change our plans. And I knew Kerala in the south of India had tea plantations and a tea factory. So that was a compromise. We had to go in February though, not October, because October would be too wet in Kerala. But we flew to Bangalore. It was a magical trip. Bangalore, stayed down in Mysore. We were driven by a wonderful man called Shiju, all the way through Tamil Nadu. We stayed in Ooty, which is one of the most famous hill stations, probably more famous than Darjeeling, but not quite as famous as Shimla. And we stayed there, so we got to see the life, well, today's life, in a hill station that was tremendously popular with the British many years ago in the time of the Raj. And we went through, then we went to Kerala. I went to Moonar. I saw the tea factory, I saw tea plantations, and stayed on the backwaters in a peasant rights boat, which was so interesting, and spent a little bit of time, a couple of days down by the beach there, but we didn't really particularly want a beach holiday. There was so much more to see. And then we ended up in Cochin, called Kochi, which I love. So I set two books, one Darjeeling Inheritance, which is in the tea, but that is followed by Cochin Fall, because I loved Cochin. I thought it was super, super place. And so a different story, but I've set that there. So it was a magical time in India, yeah. And I really loved it. And one day I will go back again. Mm-hmm. Yes, I did enjoy it.
It sounds lovely, and indeed one of the pleasure actually of being a writer is to do the research and see it with your own eyes and get the inspiration, eat the food and the smells, and of course
the smells and the ground under your feet. It's impossible. You can read it, you can look on YouTube, you can do an awful lot, but nothing is like actually going there in person. Doing it, and you make contacts. When I was writing the book, there were one or two things I needed to know, and I contacted the man who was in charge of the Cochin Club, who was able to answer some of my questions, which was really, really helpful. It was unfortunate that because of lockdown at the time, universities and galleries were closed, but I did manage to get the help I needed so I could fill out my story. But it it was a lovely, lovely trip. Very lucky. And of course, it was all tax deductible.
What about you, Walt? How do you go with your research?
I've done the YouTube thing, but I also spend a lot of time in books. I've got a number of research books that my library, if I can show it to you, is everywhere, here, there, downstairs. My wife thinks I'm nuts. But some of the books I depend on. There was a, one of the best books I ever found was a book called Learning from Shogun. It's, you can actually, it's free to download online. It was written by or edited by a professor from Columbia. The book, the novel Shogun was so popular, it's about 1,000 pages long, that a group of Japanese history professors put together a 200-page book on what Clavel got wrong.
Okay.
And so it's not the trip because it's one of the most wonderful books ever, but Clavel basically rolled back. A lot of his stuff is anywhere from 30 to 50 years too early.
Mm-hmm.
And to appear when it does. I love the book. It's the most brilliant thing, but these professors went through and did 200 pages of, okay, it was really like this. It was really like this. And so when you've got a source written by experts like that,
mm-hmm.
it's amazing that you can put it in there. There's another book I have, Louis Freud, who was a Portuguese Jesuit in the country, wrote mm-hmm. a huge book about what are the differences between the Japanese and the Europeans. Things like the fact that they get up on the right side of the horse, we get up on the left. They raise their kids like this, they do this. And there's a ton of little things. And then there's also sailors' diaries. The University of Michigan has a Japanese studies library that is huge. And I've never visited it. I'd love to get lost in it. But got a number of books of actual things that have been translated into English. And I've gone through it. Okay, this is what they were thinking. This is what they were thinking. And it is an amazing, there's a lot of amazing stuff that is out there. And then I get really fanatical on details. So I'm checking star charts. I'm checking when everything, because in my books, they're set in the late 16th century. Mm-hmm. So the Jesuits are operating under a Western calendar and mm-hmm. the Japanese are operating under a lunar one.
Yes.
Which makes for an interesting conversation. And also finding where everything is. But that's, there's a lot of research that I do. In fact, I have a YouTube channel.
Mm-hmm.
And on my YouTube channel, I have a lecture that I did last year for the Japan mm-hmm. Writers Conference on how I research my books.
Okay.
I recorded a backup just in case something went wrong on the day of the lecture. The lecture never got posted, but the backup that I had just in case we had a total whatever, internet connectivity meltdown. That way I wouldn't be leaving them high and dry. But that's actually on there. It's about an hour's worth of how I go through all this. But it's just all the interesting little facts that you pick up from things like that, books that you don't see.
Yes, absolutely. Sometimes the details are what makes a book interesting. We were discussing today with two other authors, with Carol and Larry, and we also said that, of course, you know, you do the research is not to put everything inside your book, but you just pick what you need to make the book, you know, more credible and lively and real.
You do, and an acquaintance of mine who is the best, and I say, she wrote, Dr. Nessa Riley, she wrote Island Queen, which was the summer read. And I was at a book signing. She lives in Atlanta. She lives in Atlanta area. So I was at a book signing of hers. And I asked her about that, some of the stuff that she looked at me and said, you write what you can, but you be vague for the rest of it.
Okay.
And so you only know so much, you only have so much, and you can only find out so much. So you learn to deal with that, and her books are, and she's also writes historical fiction, her books are amazing. But that was a suggestion she had for me at her book signing.
Okay.
And it's just getting that out and presenting it in that way. That is a challenge, I think, for any writer.
Yes. And are any of you thinking of setting up your next book also in Asia, or for the time being you still have no plans, or you don't know?
Well, the book after Cochin Fall, Hanoi Spring, was set in Vietnam, And I feel very privileged. I was lucky enough to go to Vietnam just before coronavirus was known about. And so I brought it back with me. But I had the most wonderful trip, flying to Saigon, going down to the Mekong Delta. And we went to the little outlying villages, drove bicycles through, saw how people lived, did the rug making, dealt with the coconuts. And it was just fascinating. And some of the beliefs, had a very, very good tour guide for the whole of that area, who told us how the people lived and what they believed. And then went back to Saigon, spent a few days there, it's the most beautiful city. Then flew up to Da Nang, went to Hoi An, spent 5 hours in a cookery lesson because I wanted to learn how to cook. I felt that would be helpful to know how to cook Vietnamese food, and made a wonderful meal. There were about 20 of us doing it, and bought every single utensil that we'd use, got the recipe, got everything organized. But every time I look at it now, I'm back at home, I think, oh, I can't be bothered. So I'm afraid there'll be historic reminder of something I did, but it'll never rust through use, only through non-use. But then I went up to Hanoi, went to Hue, which I like, the imperial city. I wish I'd spent longer in Hue. And then flew up to Hanoi. And oh, it's such a buzzy city. I really did like it. I did everything. Sat down on the little tables that are very low for the street food to eat all of those. Remember, was once you got down, you had to get up again. So it took people on either side hauling me up. But everything they did, I did. I just thought it was a lovely city. I loved it. And I thought, I'm going to set a book. And I was going to set it in Saigon. But in the end, I changed my mind. And for the same reason as Paul Loomer, who did so much of the development of Hanoi, he was going to develop Saigon. He decided that was too set, too already formed. He wanted a clean sheet, and that was Hanoi. But it was a very difficult book to write because I've been used to all the research I'd done for Darjeeling Inheritance and in Asia with the Indian, the British Raj. And I found a very different kind of information about the way the Vietnamese were treated. They were, in fact, treated quite appallingly by the French. And I'm someone who used to teach French. I go to France regularly. I love France. But you can't ignore history. You can't rewrite it, cancel it, say it doesn't exist. The Vietnamese treat it very badly. And that informs the story. And it's the first book that hasn't been marketed as a romance. There are people in love in it, but it isn't a romantic story in the same way. I just felt I went to the Hanoi Hilton, it's called, the jail. I just felt I had to be true to what I read in my research. I got a lot of books. And I also got a very good book written called Dumb Luck by a Vietnamese. And I got a book by somebody all about the myths and legends. I put one of the legends in there because I thought it was fascinating, because that tells you something about the way a people believe. Myths and legends passed from one generation to another through the centuries. And so the people you're writing about, we have to get into their minds. And if we know the kind of stories they're given, we will understand so much more about the way they think. And that will affect the way they respond to everything that they encounter in their life. So I did enjoy writing Hanoi Spin, but I found it a very difficult book. And I think it's slightly different in tone from anything else I've written. And I am doing one more in Asia. I'm writing Shimla Mist, but that will probably be my last set in Asia because I might do another family.
Okay, interesting. And then Waltz, next in Asia?
I'm currently working on a book set in Osaka in 1590. I've already written it. I'm going back to editing it. It's the synopsis is with one publisher. If they take it, great. If not, I'll self-publish it. But it's, like I said, it's a challenge because Osaka operated very differently from the rest of Japan. Mm-hmm. And so it's another situation where you don't have a lot of information.
Okay.
And I'm trying to work through that. I also have a novel that I've started after that. And that will finish Japan for a while on that section. And then I've got my time travel books set in Japan, which are going to continue. And this, it's great to have Liz on because I've actually got a draft that hasn't seen the light of day set in Kerala. My first trip to Japan.
Yeah. What year is it?
Lovely.
Well, you know, Kerala wasn't called Kerala until 1957.
Yes, I know. I know. It is set. I'm fascinated with St. Thomas. So yeah. That and the story of his missionary work in India. Yeah. And so it's not, again, it's like all my books, it's historical fiction with just religious elements. He's in it, but it's not a Christian type book. But he's part of it. And so, but it's set when he's there, right around 57, 58 AD.
Oh, gosh. Well, that'd be fascinating.
The time period that nobody has any information about. There's two dynasties in that era.
Fill in the gaps.
Yeah, but in the middle, in the biblical era, there's nothing.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, they weren't colonized till the Portuguese. The Portuguese were the first people to colonize India. Yes. And they went into Cochin, as it's called today. That was the first part of the colonization. You can still see odd traces, but there is more of the Dutch who followed them present in Cochin. The houses tend to be more Dutch. It's fascinating, it's lovely.
It is. It really is. The history is wonderful.
That's great. So many books coming out of this this geographical area. It's so rich from everything. That's nice. So do you want to give a short overview of your book and tell us where readers can find you and your book?
But the book that my book that's in the promotion is Hanoi Spring, and it's available every single Amazon bookshop, paperback, ebook, and in any bookshop anybody wants to go in and order it, it would be bought in. And if anybody wants to visit my website, that would be very nice. May I mention that, Lorca? www.lizharrisauthor.com, and that tells you a bit about my books, a little bit about me. And if you sign up for my newsletter, which I do every month, keeping people up to date with the sort of things I've been doing, then you get a free book as a thank you present. It isn't a book that's set in Asia. It isn't a historical novel. It's a little bit inspired by my time in California and some of the rather stupid things I did, created into a love story. But I have to say, I never worked for a very handsome film star, though I would have liked to have done so. Hanoi Spring, it's authentic. And my website, I would welcome you to it.
Okay, thank you, Lisa. Walt?
My book in the promotion is called A Second Chance. Basically, a woman of Japanese descent in the Georgia area crashes into a lake outside of Atlanta, wakes up in a lake in late 16th century Japan. She's a concubine to a samurai who's been condemned to death for cowardice. And she learns that the sentence includes not only the samurai, but his entire family, including herself and the son she shares with him. I refer to the book as Quantum Leap meets Shogun, where you see the old Quantum Leap series where the character Samuel Beckett jumps back in another character. Where he's still that other person. He's inhabiting the body of the other person. That's what's happened here. And so she has to, basically my character has to figure out what went wrong in the 16th century and save the kid.
Okay.
That's where it all begins.
Okay, that sounds exciting. And where we can find
there's for people who are interested, my website, waltmussell.com, waltmussell.com. Sign up for my newsletter. You can get a copy of a novella called The Samurai's Honor. It's set in 1577. It's the prequel to my book, The Samurai's Heart. And you also can find my videos on YouTube and TikTok. I do Japanese history videos, short Japanese history videos.
Okay.
And they're posted on both. I love subscribers to check them out. The videos are all, most of the videos are 3 minutes or less. And then you've got a few longer lectures. One, the how to research, how I research my books. And I also do I also give lectures on Japan's Christian century. Japan went through a Christian century where the Jesuits came. It went from zero to 300,000 plus, and then back down to zero again in about 90 plus years, 1549 to 16, to sometime in 1650, around 1640, 1650. And so I talk about that with at churches. I talk about it at libraries. It's a free lecture. I'm willing to do it online. Just reach out to me through my website. And I'll be happy to do the lecture on the lecture for you. But it's on Japan's Christian century, and I call it The Path to Silence. So those lectures were posted. A series of those lectures were posted when COVID started. And then I started adding the other Japanese history as well.
I see. Okay. And your book is both a paperback and the ebook?
Yes. Sorry. Yes. It can be, you can buy it anywhere. For paperback, you have to order it, but you can download it on, of course, Amazon, Apple, Kobo, just about anywhere.
Okay.
And other services too. There's more services than that, because the way I've got it set up, it goes to some distributors whose names I don't even know in other countries. But it is available. It's called A Second Chance.
Okay.
And you can find links on my website if you have trouble finding it.
Perfect. Well, I think that's all for our chat. That was very interesting. And I really love to hear to other authors' stories and connections with Asia. And I wish, of course, all the best for the promotion, and hope to hear from you as well.
Thank you very much for inviting us to take part. I think it's been great fun. I've thoroughly enjoyed hearing what Walter had to say, and I look forward to looking at some of his books and also the book about Kerala.
You as well. I've got to see your books on India.
We all got each other's readers now.
Yes, indeed. Thank you. That's very, very kind of you to have done this.
Thank you very much.
Good luck, Walter. Good luck, Laura, with your book. Bye-bye.
Good luck to you both.